will have an amazing week.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United States and South Korea are holding their biggest combined military training in years as they heighten their defense posture against the growing North Korean nuclear threat. The drills could draw an angry response from North Korea, which has pushed its weapons testing activity to a record pace this year. The Ulchi Freedom Shield exercises will continue through September 1st in South Korea and include field exercises involving aircraft, warships, tanks, and potentially tens of thousands of troops. Similar drills were canceled or shrunk in recent years due to COVID-19 or to create space for diplomacy. North Korea last week harshly criticized South Korea's president for continuing military exercises with the United States. The daughter of an influential Russian political theorist, often referred to as Putin's brain, was killed in a car bombing on the outskirts of Moscow, according to authorities. The Moscow branch of the Russian Investigative Committee said preliminary information indicated 29-year-old TV commentator Daria Dugina was killed by an explosive planted in the SUV she was driving Saturday night. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the bloodshed gave rise to suspicions that the intended target was her father, Alexander Dugin, a nationalist philosopher and writer. Dugin is a prominent proponent of the Russian world concept, a spiritual and political ideology that emphasizes traditional values, the restoration of Russia's power, and the unity of all ethnic Russians throughout the world. He's also a vehement supporter of Russian President Vladimir Putin's move sending troops into Ukraine. Again, the daughter of the influential Russian political theorist, often referred to Putin's brain, was killed in a car bombing on the outskirts of Moscow, according to authorities on Sunday. She is Daria Dugin, a 29-year-old TV commentator. This is VOA News. Japan's prime minister is now quarantining after now testing positive for COVID-19. More from VOA's Joe Ramsey.
Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has mild symptoms of COVID-19 and has canceled his planned travels while he isolates and recuperates. An official in his office said Sunday that Kishida developed a slight fever and cough late Saturday and tested positive for the coronavirus. The 65-year-old prime minister was on vacation last week and was scheduled to return to work Monday. Kishida won't go in person to a conference on African development later this month in Tunisia, but will participate online. He also postponed his trip to the Middle East. COVID-19 is surging in Japan, although most people, including Kishida, have been vaccinated. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Polioviruses recently found in Jerusalem, New York, and London were mutated versions of viruses that first originated in vaccines meant to stamp out the paralytic disease. That is a surprising twist in the decades-long effort to eradicate polio. For years, global health officials have used an oral vaccine in an attempt to wipe out the disease and its last remaining strongholds in countries such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. In recent weeks, scientists have found evidence of polio spreading within Israel, the U.S., and Britain. Genetic analyses show that the viruses were linked to the oral vaccine itself. U.S. First Lady Jill Biden has left COVID-19 isolation after twice testing negative for the coronavirus and has reunited with U.S. President Joe Biden at the Delaware Beach home. She had been isolating in South Carolina, where she tested positive for the virus as the couple wrapped up a vacation there last week. An aide says the First Lady arrived in Delaware Sunday afternoon, and like the president, Joe Biden has been double vaccinated and boosted with the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. She tested positive last Tuesday and was prescribed the antiviral drug Paxlovid. President Biden recently recovered from a rebound case of COVID-19. Pope Francis voiced worry Sunday about the situation in Nicaragua, where police detained several Roman Catholic clergy, including a bishop critical of President Daniel Ortega's administration. Calling for open and sincere dialogue, the pontiff made his first public comment on Friday at the Matagalpa Bishop Rolando Alvarez's residence. The detention of him and an unknown number of priests came amid worsening tensions between the church and the government, increasingly intolerant of dissent. Recapping our top story, the United States and South Korea are holding their biggest combined military training in years as they heighten their defense posture against the growing North Korean nuclear threat. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Monday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, a weekend hotel siege in Somalia is over.
Casualties include civilians and security personnel who were killed in the Al-Shabaab complex attack on the Hyatt Hotel.
Angolans will decide who they want for their next president on Wednesday.
It does seem on the face of it that this coming election might be Angola's most competitive election since 1992.
And the daughter of an influential political theorist in Russia is killed in a suspected car bombing. We'll have these stories and more next. Somali Federal Police said Sunday that security forces had ended the Mogadishu Hotel siege by the Al-Qaeda-affiliated militant group Al-Shabaab after nearly 30 hours of operations. Officials say more than 20 people were killed in that attack. Mohamed Daisane reports from Mogadishu.
At a press conference in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, Sunday, Somali Police Chief General Abdi Hassan Hijjar said that casualties include civilians and security personnel who were killed in the Al-Shabaab complex attack on the Hyatt Hotel in the center of the city near Somalia's Criminal Investigation Department headquarters. He said the main focus of the security forces was rescuing trapped civilians after Al-Shabaab fighters targeted the hotel with explosions and stormed the building, followed by a firefight that lasted nearly 30 hours. He added that the security agencies involved in the operations, who ended the siege at midnight, rescued more than 106 people, including women and children. He says he wants to share with Somali people in the country and abroad that the operations at Hyatt Hotel ended at midnight. During the operations, he said, the security forces focused on rescuing and securing the civilians trapped in the hotel, and more than 106 people, including children and women, were rescued. It is shocking that innocent civilians have died there. Dr. Abdulqadir Abdulrahman Adan, the founder of Amin Ambulance, part of the emergency team involved in taking civilians to hospitals, told VOA by phone Sunday that despite difficulties, their team was able to transport wounded people to hospitals for treatment.
Amin Ambulance, waxay qaaday.
He says Amin picked up 11 wounded people and 7 bodies, including men and women. The Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the deadly attack on Hyatt Hotel in Mogadishu and claimed it had killed 63 people and wounded 107 others. The attack was made with international condemnation. The United States said it strongly condemned the attack. A statement issued by the U.S. State Department expresses heartfelt condolences to the families who lost loved ones, wishes a full recovery to those injured, and commends Somali security forces. The statement added that the United States remains steadfast in its support of Somali and African Union-led efforts to counter terrorism and build a secure and prosperous future for the people of Somalia. The Intergovernmental Authority for Development in Eastern Africa, or IGAD, also condemned the attack. Noor Mahmoud Sheikh, spokesperson for the Executive Secretary of IGAD, told VOA that the attack was a terrible disaster for the entire region.
Look, this is a terrible disaster, not just for Somalia, but the entire IGAD region. The region is in mourning. Our executive secretary did condemn this heinous criminal act in the strongest terms possible. Acts of terror are a threat to both the national, regional, and global peace and stability, and must be defeated collectively. So we shall be working very closely with all the regional actors, international partners, and of course, with the government and people of Somalia to defeat terrorism collectively.
This was the first deadly attack by Al-Shabaab on an upscale target in Mogadishu since Somalia's new president Hassan Sheikh Mohamud took office in May. The attack also was the longest hotel siege in Somalia since Al-Shabaab started its insurgency more than 15 years ago. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
The daughter of an ultra-nationalist Russian ideologue who pushed for Russia absorbing Ukraine was killed in a suspected car bomb attack outside Moscow on Saturday night, according to Russian authorities. The Moscow branch of the Russian Investigative Committee said preliminary information indicated a bomb exploded in the SUV driven by 29-year-old Daria Dugina. She was a TV commentator and daughter of Alexander Dugina, who is often referred to as Putin's brain. Russian media say the blast took place as Dugina was returning from a cultural festival she had attended with her father, President Vladimir Putin. An advisor to Ukraine's president denied any Ukrainian involvement in the car bomb attack. Ukraine's healthcare system, which has already suffered from corruption, mismanagement, and the pandemic, has deteriorated even more rapidly since the start of the war, which has reached its six-month mark. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas has this report.
As she shows AP journalists the way into the hospital, head doctor Ilona Butova takes them down damaged corridors, her feet cracking shattered glass as she walks. Butova tells the AP, "We had 120 men before the start of the war. This included not only medical personnel, but also service personnel. At the moment, 47 people remain with us." Ukraine's health system, paralyzed by extensive war damage and a massive exodus of people, is being propped up by volunteers and doctors who refuse to leave. 79-year-old Vanda Bendarovska was one of the patients saved by volunteers. Her son was killed by a Russian artillery attack and her home destroyed in the war. "There is no one to help me. No place to live, no child. Everything was overcome and nothing was left behind." I'm Karen Chamas.
Australia has reacted with shock and dismay after confirmation that the bomb maker for the Bali terror attack in 2002 has again had his prison sentence reduced. As Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, 202 people, including 88 Australians, died in the attack in October 2002, along with victims from Indonesia, Britain, the United States, and other countries.
Umar Patek, a member of the al-Qaeda-linked Jamaat Islamiyah militant group, was jailed for 20 years in 2012. He was convicted of making the bombs that tore through two nightclubs a decade earlier on the Indonesian island of Bali. 202 people were killed, including 88 Australians. This week he was granted the latest of several small cuts to his sentence, as part of remissions given to inmates to mark Indonesia's August 17 Independence Day holiday. He's now eligible for parole this month because he served two-thirds of his prison sentence. Patek was one of Asia's most wanted men and was on the run for almost a decade before he was arrested in Pakistan. Officials insist he's been de-radicalized. Indonesia's Justice Ministry must give final approval for his release. In Australia, there's anger and dismay that one of the key architects of the Bali attack could soon walk free. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
"This will be of concern for the families involved. We continue to make diplomatic representations in Australia's interest and will continue to do that across a range of issues relating to security and relating to sentences."
Bali bombing mastermind Hambali, also known as Ensep Najaman, is being held at the US facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba and has been awaiting trial since 2006. Three other key conspirators were executed in November 2008. Others were killed by Indonesian police before facing trial. The Bali bombings deeply affected Australia. The Indonesian island was a popular tropical vacation destination. The attack shattered Australia's sense of isolated security. While the bombings weren't carried out on Australian soil, they felt too close to home. The victims came from more than 20 countries, including Brazil, Germany, Japan and New Zealand. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United Nations has allocated $5 million from its Central Emergency Response Fund, or CERF, to address Haiti's growing destitution caused by gang violence. Lisa Schlein has the details for VOA from Geneva.
UN aid agencies say since July, nearly 500 people have been killed in clashes between gangs in Haiti's Cité Soleil, an extremely poor and densely populated area in the capital, Port-au-Prince. The UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimates nearly 280,000 people are trapped by the fighting. The agency warns conditions are worsening as growing violence is keeping people from food, drinking water, and health care. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says the money released by CERF will help underfunded humanitarian agencies respond to Haitians' immediate needs. He acknowledges that $5 million is a small amount, but says it is a critical amount of money right now.
Funding through UNICEF and WFP, our colleagues, will provide food, drinking water, health care, mental health and education support to more than 100,000 people in total. What often happens when we inject money from the CERF is that other donors follow, because it comes, of course, with a message and a signal that this is critical life-saving interventions we need now.
UNICEF says about 20% of Cité Soleil children under age 5 suffer from severe or moderate acute malnutrition. It says thousands are at risk of dying because gang violence prevents them from receiving adequate health and nutrition care. The World Food Programme says nearly half of Haiti's population, some 4.4 million people, are going hungry. Laerke says providing aid to the many people in need is a challenge.
The high level of insecurity in Haiti is compromising humanitarians' access to affected people, for example, for food and cash distributions, but also to basic services such as health and education for between 1 and 1.5 million people trapped in gang-controlled neighborhoods in the Port-au-Prince metropolitan area.
OCHA warns the outlook for an estimated 4.9 million Haitians in need of humanitarian assistance is not promising. It notes the United Nations has received just 14% of the $373 million it needs for its life-saving operations this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA News. Millions of Angolans head to the polls on Wednesday for parliamentary elections that will also decide the country's new leader. The main presidential candidates are incumbent President João Lourenço, the hand-picked successor of longtime ruler José Eduardo dos Santos, and Adalberto Costa Jr., the leader of the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola, or UNITA, which was converted into a political party from a rebel movement after the country's civil war. Paul Nantulia, a research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says Costa appears to be holding a slight lead in the latest polls.
He seems to be in the lead in most opinion polls, seems to have made a lot of inroads in some of the MPLA's traditional strongholds. So it does seem on the face of it that this coming election might be Angola's most competitive election since 1992. When multi-party politics was introduced in the country.
Tell us a little bit about the candidate with UNITA.
Yes, he represents the younger emerging crop of politicians that has been coming up in Angola over the past decade. He's a member of parliament. He's a very charismatic member of parliament. He is seen as a reformer with very, very strong reform credentials. He has been able to establish himself as a candidate that identifies very strongly with the need to make the Angolan state much more accountable, the need to take into serious consideration the issues of corruption, high-level corruption, and very importantly, the youth. He has quite a following among young people. He's young himself. For the first time since independence, the Angolans who did not experience the civil war between the MPLA and UNITA, which are very bitter rivals, will be voting in this election for the first time. So the memories of the civil war, the memories of that historical tension between UNITA and MPLA are very distant to this group, to this constituency. So Adalberto represents that energy.
President Lourenco has been praised abroad for his whole anti-corruption drive shortly after he took office. But critics say that this corruption crackdown has really only been very selective. What do you say about that?
Yes, well, indeed, President Lourenco has projected himself right from the very beginning as a reformer, as somebody who wanted to uproot the old MPLA power structure that has been in the country very, very, very deeply entrenched since independence. He has also sought to distance himself from the excesses of the past, and also to distance himself from his boss, from his former boss. And this has been popular. It has been popular among Angolans, and it's also been very popular among the youth, as I mentioned. So he has tried to project himself as a reformer. However, there's a lot of criticism that these efforts have largely been cosmetic and have largely been aimed at securing some kind of alternative political base for Lourenco.
That was Paul Nantulia, research associate with the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking to me here in Washington last week. In other news, the Iraqi health ministry said Sunday at least 4 people were killed after a landslide destroyed a Shiite Muslim shrine in the central Iraqi province of Karbala. Rescue workers pulled out 6 survivors from the rubble after Saturday's landslide. The search and rescue operation was continuing into the night in case more people remain buried and under the rubble, according to a ministry statement. Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong said on Sunday the country will repeal a colonial-era section of Singapore's penal code, which will decriminalize gay sex in Singapore, but added that same-sex marriage will continue to be illegal in the city-state. In his annual policy address, broadcast live on television, he said that, quote, sex between consenting men should not be criminalized, end quote. Polioviruses recently found in Jerusalem, London, and New York were mutated versions that first originated in vaccines meant to stamp out the disease, a surprising twist in the decades-long quest to eradicate polio. For years, global health officials have used an oral vaccine in an effort to wipe out the disease in its last remaining strongholds in countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. A federal appeals court in the U.S. has put on hold Senator Lindsey Graham's testimony in an election probe involving former President Donald Trump. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker has more.
A special grand jury is investigating plots to overturn Trump's 2020 presidential election loss in Georgia. A subpoena had instructed the South Carolina Republican to testify, but that's on hold while a decision is made over whether the subpoena should be partially quashed or modified because of protections granted to members of Congress. The investigation stems from a phone call with Trump and the then Georgia Secretary of State suggesting he could find the votes needed to overturn his loss there. The DA wants to ask Graham about calls he made in connection with that. I'm Julie Walker.
Over a month after the controversial Supreme Court ruling that overturned a New York gun safety law requiring a license to carry concealed weapons in public, the conversation continues. Evgeny Maslov has the story on the state of the U.S. gun debate, narrated by Anna Rice.
Now, put the safety on, right? Red dot means fire. The safety on. Is the gun safe?
Latif Dickerson, the director of the New Jersey Firearms Academy, has been in the gun business for 27 years. He trains people planning to get a gun or gun license in New Jersey.
And we have basic, intermediate, and advanced training that we do with all different types of firearms. We compete. We have a competitive shooting team.
A few hours in the classroom and then practice at a shooting range. Dickerson says he's seen more people signing up for training and more people willing to buy a gun or rifle. He says news reports about mass shootings in the country are making people think more about self-defense.
Everyone should have the ability to protect themselves and not have to rely on others for their own safety.
Many Americans believe owning a gun and knowing how to use it gives people a chance to protect themselves when the police aren't available. Dickerson supports the idea of background checks for gun buyers, but says that the personal responsibility of gun owners is most important, as well as knowing how to handle guns safely.
You don't want to be out there and you don't know how to properly engage. This class has a lot of interesting points as far as legal-wise.
In June, the Supreme Court declared that a New York gun control law restricting the carrying of concealed firearms was unconstitutional. The decision set off protests in New York, and authorities promised to find new ways to control the situation.
In light of today's ruling by the United States Supreme Court in this case, we cannot idly stand by and just watch our streets be flooded with guns due to more people being permitted to legally carry firearms in public.
New York lawmakers have since designated parts of the city as gun-free zones, like government buildings, schools, and houses of worship. Not surprisingly, gun rights advocates say the situation should be handled differently.
We should have armed security guards in the school, since we know that the school is a soft target, so we need to protect that. Somebody else's concern for their safety should not restrict my rights, and I'm a law-abiding person.
The gun control debate is one of the most heated in a country where the right to bear arms is written into its constitution. For Yevgeny Maslov in New Jersey, NRI's VOA News.
To all our VOA listeners, please note, you will now find us, International Edition, that is, back on our general website, voanews.com. There you will find other VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. This has been VOA's International Edition. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than five decades ago, at the height of the Cold War, representatives of 18 nations drafted the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT. In the years that followed, nearly every country in the world joined the NPT. The NPT has made the world safer as nuclear weapons states took steps to reduce their stockpiles. However, the treaty is under increasing strain, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a speech to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference. He noted that the DPRK continues to expand its unlawful nuclear program and continues its ongoing provocations against the region. Iran also remains on a path of nuclear escalation. Although it publicly claims to favor a return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, since March, Iran has been unwilling to accept such a deal. Secretary Blinken affirmed that getting back to the JCPOA remains the best outcome for the United States, for Iran, for the world. Russia's ongoing war of aggression against Ukraine is a brazen violation of international law, but its actions also violate the assurances that it provided to Ukraine in the 1994 Budapest Memorandum. Under the terms of the memorandum, which welcomed Ukraine's accession to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and its commitment to remove all nuclear weapons from its territory, Russia committed to respect Ukraine's independence and territorial integrity. This sends the worst possible message to countries around the world that may think they need to have nuclear weapons to protect their sovereignty. There is no place in our world for nuclear deterrence based on coercion, intimidation, or blackmail, declared Secretary Blinken.
Together with the United Kingdom and France, we've released a set of principles and best practices that should be expected of every responsible NPT nuclear weapon state, among them that every effort has to be made to ensure that nuclear weapons are not used again.
The United States is committed to avoiding costly arms races and facilitating arms control arrangements wherever they are possible. Indeed, President Biden negotiated to extend the New START treaty with Russia until 2026. President Biden also reiterated his readiness to negotiate a framework to replace New START. The fundamental role of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear attacks on the United States, its allies, and partners. The United States would only consider the use of such weapons in extreme circumstances to defend its vital interests.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.